The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. On September 14th, the Burlington, Vermont City Council voted unanimously to approve a resolution authorizing a legal analysis of establishing supervised consumption sites in the city of Burlington. We'll hear part of that council meeting later on today's show. But first, a friend of mine passed away a couple of weeks ago. On September 6th, Kevin Zeese died unexpectedly in his sleep. I first met Kevin back in 1983 when I was still in college. I just started a chapter normal. Kevin was inspiring. He was brilliant, and he was patient with young people who were starting to try and figure things out. I was interested in politics. I was looking for a career, and I found one. Kevin was an early mentor. He became a good friend. Then in 2000, Kevin hired me to work with him at Common Sense for Drug Policy, where I took over Drug War Facts and blogged at the CSDP website. I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now. I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be anywhere if it weren't for Kevin Zeese. His memorial service was September 19th. One of the people who spoke was Robert Field, the founder and chairman of Common Sense for Drug Policy. Full disclosure, Robert is once again my employer. I work full-time now as a senior policy analyst for the Real Reporting Foundation. Here's Robert Field.
Thank you. You know, listening to Ralph Nader, before reading my comments, it struck me just how big a man Kevin was and just how big his ideas were. We can know someone very well, but sometimes not as well as we think. At the initial Alliance of Reform Organizations banquet, either in 1997 or 98, with about 80 members of existing and startup organizations present, Kevin explained that ARO was not to have a leader or an agenda, but rather was solely meant to facilitate discussion within the drug policy reform movement. But then Mickey Norris piped up, "But Kevin, you are our king." Mickey spoke for all of us then and now. I had the honor to co-found Common Sense for Drug Policy with Kevin. I had served for a year on the board of the Drug Policy Foundation, and Kevin had co-founded DPF years earlier with Professor Arnold Triebach, who also passed away recently, but in his case, at a ripe old age. I need not remind most of you that Arnold and Kevin kept the embers of reform burning during a time of reefer madness. Kevin and I, later joined by Hollywood's Mike Ray, wanted CSDP to help perform four functions. One, educate the media, academia, officials, and public. Two, help unite the burgeoning reform movement, a task comparable to herding cats. But Kevin was good at that. Three, create a reliable reference manual on drugs that started with an ever-growing annual booklet sent to media and academics that soon morphed into drugwarfacts.org, so ably edited for two decades by Doug McVeigh. Doug joins us today, but explained to me this morning he declined to speak lest he choke up with tears. And four, along with our modest grants, Kevin provided valuable advice and much encouragement to dozens of fledgling reform organizations, something he did for the poor and the downtrodden for the rest of his life. Our initial goals achieved, and others ably taking the movement in the direction of initiatives and referendums, Kevin and I went our separate ways, but remained friends and supportive of one another. I am 83, and Kevin was 64. After Kevin's death, Margaret relayed a sad irony. Kevin had mentioned to her some time ago that I had asked him to speak at the memorial that likely would follow my death. We never know.
That was Robert Field. He's the co-founder and chairman of Common Sense for Drug Policy and the Real Reporting Foundation. He's also a friend, mentor, and my boss. He was speaking at a memorial service for my friend, mentor, and colleague, Kevin Zeese. One of the other speakers at that memorial service was Kimon Freeman. Kimon is a good friend. He's an activist and organizer based in Washington, D.C. He's the founder of We Act Radio. Here's Kimon.
Looks like what drives me crazy don't have no effect on you. But I'm going to keep on at it till it drives you crazy, too. Langston Hughes. It's been said that in a world of insanity, it's the strong that goes crazy. It is the weak that pretends that there is nothing wrong. Kevin Zeese was crazy strong. First, let me start by saying all power to the people. KZ, as I like to call him, said that. I like to start by saying how much of an honor it is to be joined here today with all of you distinguished people to pay our respects to a man in a space where God is not welcome. That's right. As his dedicated life partner, Dr. Margaret Flowers, would say, there's no God in this house. Let the church say amen. Amen. KZ said that God is the adult Santa Claus. He asked me one time while we were smoking weed together, why are Black people so religious? I told him because they needed a warm, fuzzy blanket to get through the winter in America. But where is God when there's no healthcare plan, no infrastructure plan, no plan to deal with the pandemic, no plan to deal with the climate crisis, no plan to deal with structural racism, no plan to deal with economic injustice, and no plan to deal with the housing crisis or canceling rent? But we can always pay to pray. But KZ had a plan. He shared it brilliantly and passionately with the Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Chris Hedges, who I'm also deeply honored to appear here with today, on his show On Contact. And I urge everyone to please check out the tribute video we produced based around that interview, because KZ left us a blueprint. George Orwell said, in times of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. KZ was indeed a revolutionary. Just listen to a small sample of working titles of projects he and Dr. Margaret Flowers were involved with. Shift the Power, Democratize the Economy, It's Our Economy, Build Power and Resistance, Occupy DC, Democratize the Media, Popular Resistance, and of course, Clearing the Fog, Forces of Greed, radio show. I had the good fortune to sit in the studio with these well-informed people while they recorded every Monday at 11 a.m. on We Act Radio for a number of years. But my relationship with KZ goes much further back than that. He was my mentor of 20 years. Without his presence in my life, there would be no We Act Radio. I met KZ at a meeting where he was speaking on drug reform. He blew me away immediately. At the time, I was organizing a community awareness event called the Black Love Festival. So I went up to him afterwards and asked him would he like to be the first white man to speak at the Black Love Festival. He accepted the invitation. He showed up, and the only white people there were him and the police. At the time, the festival was the largest AIDS mobilization in DC, when the AIDS infection rate was 12 times the national average simply because of congressional tyranny over the budget of DC. It was September 2001, and the festival was the first event after a 9/11 5 days later. Able to still draw a crowd, KZ said, you got something there. He offered to write me proposals to apply for grants and asked for my email address. I told him I didn't even have a computer. He immediately offered me free use of his home office on Harvard Street and gave me a key. I learned so much in that house that I like to say that I went to Harvard. He hosted so many influential people there and invited me to everything. I love how immediately after a congressman or a congresswoman left, he would break out the weed and say, let's smoke. Unfortunately, we never got any of the grants we applied for, and it had nothing to do with the weed. So KZ, head of Common Sense for Drug Policy at the time, sponsored me to attend a national conference, People of Color and the War on Drugs. I traveled to cities all over the country. He even allowed me to host my own events in his house. And once, when he traveled abroad for an extended time, he asked me would I house sit for him. I was like, you mean live in the house with the granite kitchen top and the pool table for free? Yeah, I can do that. He was always that generous with me. He got me a gig with Ralph Nader's 2004 presidential campaign, driving a corporate crime buster promo van in New York City, and the honor of reading a poem and introducing Mr. Nader at a Wall Street rally. I remember when he ran for the Maryland Senate. It was one of the few times that a third-party candidate was allowed into the debates. But it was not an act of charity or progress. It was simply Michael Steele's fruitless strategy to split the support for Ben Cardin. I believe KZ won all those debates. But when the Washington Post covered the debates, they only showed a picture of the Republican and Democratic candidate with five arms. Refusing to be cropped out, he managed to get his arm in to photobomb the corporate omission. He camped out at the FCC during his attacks on net neutrality. He stopped Obama's Trans-Pacific Partnership secret exploitative trade deal. He slept outside of Freedom Plaza during the coldest months of the year during Occupy DC. When he was facing federal charges for defending the Venezuelan embassy from the US government, some idiot took his picture in the courtroom, which apparently was a federal offense. And when he saw it, he asked me, "If you knew who took the pic, could you send me a, make sure I get a copy?" He taught me so much through his actions that it inspired me to take more action. So when we launched We Act Radio, he was the first person I called. When I wrote a screenplay on John Brown and Langston Hughes' family connection to the famed abolitionist, he was the first person I called to read for John Brown on stage. We went on to squeeze 130 people into the Langston Hughes room at Busboys and Poets for our stage reading. Like John Brown, KZ was a modern day abolitionist. Like William Kunstler, KZ was a lawyer. Like Eugene Debs, he ran for office as a third party candidate. Like Emma Goldman, he was a political writer. Like Abby Hoffman, he was an activist in the highest regard. We have the power to make the nation ungovernable. People have power. They say, "No, we're not going to do it." The nation becomes ungovernable. That's a vote of illegitimacy. We're saying the government is illegitimate. We're not going to obey it. KZ. We need public banks at every post office. We need war tax resistance. We need a general strike. We need to embrace the cancel rent movement. The iconic comedian Chris Rock just said in the New York Times that no one has less compassion for humans than a landlord. Trump is a landlord. He went on to say that Obama becoming POTUS was progress for white people. It was not progress for Black people. This is where we are. Many moons ago, KZ, Margaret, and I discussed hosting an activist award. Each year on Human Rights Day, December 10th, we should honor courageous people or organizations who work for peace and justice with a People's Movement Award. The name of the award was inspired by Howard Zinn, who wrote that his book, A People's History of the United States, is a history disrespectful of governments and respectful of people's movements of resistance. The award will be presented in the Howard Zinn Room at Busboys and Poets in Hinesville, Maryland. And the first recipient should be Kevin Zeese. I have had the pleasure of getting to know many of my most influential teachers personally. Baba Imwale Askari, a street poet. Dr. Francis Cress Wilson, a psychiatrist. Sam Greenlee, who was just mentioned in the New York Times yesterday for his work, The Spook Who Sat by the Door. And Dick Gregory, comedian and activist. Tennis champion Naomi Osaki said, "I would like to thank my ancestors, because every time I remember their blood runs through my veins, I'm reminded that I cannot lose." Now that KZ has joined the ancestors, he is the first white man to be included amongst my most influential teachers I have known personally. John Brown was the greatest white man America has ever produced. KZ was the greatest white man I have ever known in my life. He was my personal John Brown, and every time I remember that he has helped to fuel the fire that boils the blood running through my veins, I would know I got something there, and I cannot lose. Ashe, rest in power.
That was my friend Kimon Freeman, founder of We Act Radio. He was speaking at a memorial service for our mutual friend and colleague, Kevin Zeese. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. The Burlington, Vermont City Council recently approved a resolution authorizing a legal analysis of establishing a supervised consumption site. Let's hear part of that meeting. The first voice you hear will be that of Burlington City Council President Max Tracy. He introduces the rest of the speakers.
Councilor Paul, you have the floor.
Thanks very much. When I think about overdose prevention sites, which are a proven evidence-based approach to reducing overdoses to get people into treatment and recovery, an approach that is in many places around the world considered a very normal and very common response in many other countries, an approach that can help those struggling find aid and, you know, a respite from stigma. I am reminded of another program that not too long ago was considered incredibly radical in this country. Syringe exchange programs were much thought to be very radical. In some parts of this country, they still are. I find it interesting that the first syringe exchange program was developed in Amsterdam in 1983, and those exchanges were quickly seen as a very smart approach to public health. It was during the start of the HIV and AIDS epidemic. But still, despite the clear success that these programs were helping in terms of spreading blood-borne diseases, they still remained a very radical idea in the United States for well over a decade. And despite, you know, even in the face of all the evidence that they were successful, in 1988, the U.S. Congress barred federal funding for syringe exchange programs and said that the ban could only be lifted if the Surgeon General determined that they could reduce the risk of AIDS and AIDS infections without encouraging illicit drug use. It's hard to imagine that it took the Surgeon General to determine that when in fact it had been determined around the world long before that. Underground sites of syringe exchanges began to appear in 1986 when a student at Yale who had been a former IV drug user started the National AIDS Brigade. And, there were a number of them that came about in the 1980s. But even with those programs operating in over a dozen cities, there were people that were operating those sites that, despite saving lives, they were the subject of harassment, arrests, and threats of violence. 11 years followed. It took 11 years. And even with all that evidence, there was continued resistance and all sorts of arguments against syringe exchanges. Another example of our country just not being able to get out of our own way and do the right thing. And probably the biggest reason for that was just stigma. It wasn't until 1997 that a panel convened by the National Institute of Health, along with over 20 medical and scientific associations, concluded and endorsed syringe exchanges. When you think about it, it was 14 years of evidence, but it was only because advocates fought amidst a sea of stigma and resistance. So here we are with overdose prevention sites. Well, not exactly a new thing. They've been operating safely since 1986. So that's 34 years. And in all those 34 years, none of these sites have ever had a documented fatality from an overdose. Overdose prevention sites in Canada have showed a 35% decrease in overdose deaths. And we're finally beginning to see a little bit of a glimmer of hope. When we had the resolution in 2018, I don't think that we thought we would find ourselves with a glimmer of hope from Philadelphia, but it did happen last year. And now is the time for us to revisit this issue and with this resolution. The resolution asked for the city attorney to do a legal analysis to understand the statutes and regulatory frameworks, identifying specific legal strategies for overcoming any barriers to creating such a site. Despite the impediments, and actually maybe because of them, this resolution is incredibly important because it firmly expresses this council's support and endorsement of overdose prevention sites and our commitment to operating such a site when legally allowed. The other thing that is incredibly important is we need to know, so that we can plan. We all know that things take a long time, and planning now, despite the fact that we might not be able to do it tomorrow, planning now makes a lot of sense. The resolution asks for the city's opioid manager to work in consultation with Safe Recovery and the Howard Center to create that vision of what a site would look like so that we can begin to prepare for those needs. I'd just like in closing to say that I think based on, you know, a lot of what the mayor has said about the progress that we have made in Burlington, that it's absolutely critical that we join other cities, and there are other cities who are fighting for overdose prevention sites. It's important that we join them to bring our country into the 21st century thinking when it comes to harm reduction. For all of the cutting edge work that our community has done to advance harm reduction, we're the city that can be working with others to lead this effort. And I know that, you know, I haven't seen since Councillor Tracy became President Tracy that he's given up the gavel. Maybe tonight will be that night. But if he doesn't, hope that I can speak on his behalf and just saying that I think we're both very excited that we have 9 co-sponsors for this resolution, 2 others who have expressed their full support for this forward-thinking and important resolution. And, you know, while it may be potentially a few years away, and we know that this process will involve a great deal of community effort, community input, perhaps a pilot to begin with. You know, change doesn't happen by keeping silent. We certainly have all seen that. And it doesn't happen by doing nothing or by waiting. 2020 has been a really tough year. 72 deaths is 72 too many. This resolution is the right approach at the right time. And I am grateful for your support of this resolution. Thank you. And thank you at this late hour for listening to me.
Thank you, Councillor Paul. Is there discussion on the resolution? Councillor Hightower, go ahead.
Actually, I'll defer to Councillor Hanson. I'll let him go first.
Okay, go ahead, Councillor Hanson.
Great, thanks. Yeah, I just wanted to thank everyone who's worked so hard on this issue, and to the presenters, to Councillors Paul and Tracy, especially and to the mayor for your leadership on this. We did get an email communication from Brenda Siegel, who's a longtime advocate on these issues as well. And one of the issues that she had raised was around including mobile harm reduction units as part of this. I think President Tracy has told me some about that aspect, but I think it could be helpful for the council and the public if someone would be willing to speak more in depth to that. I'm not an expert on it, but I'd love to hear a little bit more about that.
Great. Thank you, Councillor Hanson. Grace, are you able to speak to the why some cities are looking at the mobile site option?
You mean mobile safe injection sites?
Yes.
I think there are a lot of reasons for that. And Sarah George might also be able to talk to some of the legal parts of that. I think, you know, for some cities that are, people have a hard time accessing these sites, that could be an option. I think we also do find whenever you could bring services to people, they avail themselves of that. There is a lot of legal work on, you know, some of the threats originally legally are asset forfeiture. So I do know that in some countries that they've looked at using what could be asset forfeitured and working through that. But there are a lot of reasons why, and especially in an area like Vermont, where you struggle to cover a lot of ground and we have some rural parts of it. I think that's probably what she's referring to. I'm trying to think of, but there are quite a few reasons that somebody would want to get these things on the road. And in other countries, they're used and successfully. So I think that's probably the majority of it. And I think, you know, having to look at all options to save lives. We know that even in Chittenden County, there's parts of Chittenden County that are very rural, and there's parts of Burlington that people still have a lot of hard times with this accessibility to services. So I'm a big proponent of putting services all under one roof when you can, so people can access, like we have a legal clinic at Safe Recovery, but also bringing services to people in a way that makes sense to them. So I think that's probably what she's talking about. Hopefully I covered it.
No, that was really helpful, and I hope helpful for everyone. I guess I was just curious, maybe to Councillor Paul, why that wasn't in the resolution.
Okay, Councillor Paul, are you able to speak to that?
You know, I mean, certainly if that is something that, you know, I'm trying to remember. When we did this back in 2018, there were concerns about that. You know, honestly, if that's something that we can work with, you know, with Grace, with Safe Recovery, with the Howard Center, and that is something that we can make work, you know, that would be great. I do think that there has been in other cities, and you know, Grace knows much more about this than I do, but I feel in other cities that has not, you know, certainly in Vancouver, I think this part of the success is having insight where insight is. You know, the other thing also, Councillor Hansen, if you look at and I can send it to you, if you look at a map of Burlington and you look at where overdoses occur, as it says in the resolution, it within about a 7 or 8 block radius is where the need is. And so I think there's an argument to be made that having a stationary site would make sense.
Great. No, that's all really helpful. It sounds like it's not necessarily, the omission of it wasn't necessarily to shut down that idea and that it's still in play. So that's really helpful to understand, but I also do understand why it wasn't emphasized given our unique situation here. So I appreciate it. Thanks.
You just heard members of the Burlington, Vermont City Council as they discussed a resolution authorizing a legal analysis of establishing a supervised consumption site. That resolution passed unanimously. Speakers included City Council President Max Tracy and council members Karen Paul, Zariah Hightower, Jack Hansen, and Ollie Ding. We also heard from Grace Keller, Program Coordinator for Howard Center Safe Recovery in Burlington. And that's it for this week. Thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network on the web at drugtruth.net. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of drugwarfacts.org. The executive producer of the Drug Truth Network is Dean Becker. Be sure to check out Dean's new video project, Claiming the Moral High Ground. Find links at drugtruth.net or search for Becker's Buds and Claiming the Moral High Ground on YouTube. Drug Truth Network programs are available by podcast. The URLs to subscribe are also on the network homepage at drugtruth.net. The Drug Truth Network has a Facebook page. Please give it a like. Drug War Facts is on Facebook, too. Give its page a like and share it with friends. Remember, knowledge is power. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.